5 days, we see that the village really rejuvenates and changes a lot. I guess that's part of the excitement of being here. My name is John Avery. I am an English teacher in Saudi Arabia at the University of Petroleum and Minerals, which is on the eastern side, the Gulf side of Saudi Arabia. My job there is to teach English to Saudi men who are attending the university, particularly in the first year of their attendance. They have to attend for 5 years minimum in order to get a degree, and the first year is just an orientation year where they take intensive English courses. That's my one credential for being here in terms of trying to explain Islam or Saudi Arabia or the Arab world, just from my experience of being there and having studied the subject. I try to think that what I present is more or less what you would feel if you were in the same situation, because I don't try to see myself as an expert in Middle Eastern politics or religions, theology or history, but just merely a layman who's studied the subject and read on my own and try to present my ideas. So take that for what it's worth. I don't. I like to be taken seriously, but not too seriously. Okay. During the week, we've talked about perceptions of Arabs and about Islam and about Iranians. We looked at the Prophet Muhammad, who was the founder of Islam and the only person to whom their scriptures were revealed in the book that they call the Quran, which means recitation, because he believed that he was told by the angel Gabriel to recite the words that were heavenly words directly to him. And we looked at some of the main precepts of Islam, particularly the five pillars, which involve daily prayers, fasting for 1 month during the year, the month of Ramadan, to celebrate the revelation that Muhammad received, a trip to Mecca once during one's lifetime as a Muslim, no matter where you live, except if need prevents you. That's three. Any other good almsgiving, right? Giving to the poor, sharing.
Did you have prayer?
And yes, ritual prayer. Okay, the prayer. Then those, the main things of Islam. I'm sorry. Of course, the one that's obvious is the proclamation of saying there is no God but God and Muhammad is his prophet. They use the name Allah for God, but that's merely a translation. And they want us very much to understand that their concept of God is the same concept that Jews and Christians have of being the one omnipotent, powerful, merciful God, worshipped throughout history in our tradition. And they want to, and they very much want to see themselves as people of the book and see us as people of the book, the Judeo-Christian heritage of Revelation. But they also see themselves as very distinct and not merely an extension of that heritage, but a different revelation. And yesterday, in the series, I talked about the history then of the Islamic peoples and how in one century after Muhammad died, a people who had never had any political power at all coalesced with red-hot inspiration and expanded beyond Arabia and extended their empire up into Spain, across North Africa, across the whole Middle Eastern area, through Persia, and up to the borders of India and into northern parts of China, and a tremendous chunk of the world's property, and a large area that had been contested for centuries among the most powerful empires of the world. So there was this immediate rush of enthusiasm and religious dedication that produced that. But also in the production of that, there was a sense of getting away from the pure religious faith And there were power divisions, particularly between the Shiites and the Sunnis. The Shiites being the people who wanted to follow Ali, one of the contestants for the most powerful position of caliph, and they persist today as the people, mainly in Iran, but also in Iraq and Pakistan and other areas. And they are the people who we have received the most information about in a negative way, because there is in their tradition very much a sense of martyrdom, of dying for the cause, and in the process of dying, one immediately enters paradise with special acknowledgement by God. So there is a sense that fear of death is diminished, that life and death are certainly not the most important elements, that serving God is more important than preservation of one's own life or the life of the children whom Iran is sending in droves to the Iraq-Iranian front. So that very briefly is a summation of what we talked about this week. And what I'm trying to do today is a very presumptuous thing, and that is trying to give a Christian response to all of that. How does one respond to a history that extends over 1,000 years or more, 1,200 years, even longer, and people whose history and theology is developed in a very expansive way and in a very divisive way. I mean, there are a lot of groups within Islam, but what I basically have done is to try to divide this up into questions of, I don't know if you can see this, or if the light permits you to see this, but I'll read as I go along. Two questions. How can we perceive, and what should our reaction be, if we are to have a reaction at all? This one. Maybe I'll switch it to you back. How can we perceive these questions, and what should our reaction be? And two things to perceive. Islam, that we've been talking about this week. Islam is a religion, and Islam is a political structure. Within Islam, there is no division of church and state. And that's a crucial thing for us to recognize, because it's so different from our history, or our present history anyway. It's more of the, if we can use the term, the Constantinian arrangement, of Constantine the emperor becoming a Christian, and the church and state were made into one within Christianity, but no longer exist except in a nominal sense in countries like England, where they have a church, a state church, the Anglican church in that case, but not in the sense of carrying the power. And in Islam, there is no idea of certain powers having different realms of influence, that they work them together, that the concept is alien to them. And so I thought, with this four-part division, Islam is a religion, and first I want to ask some questions how we can perceive that, and look at some positive points about Islam as a religion. Islam is pure monotheism. In that sense, we have a lot to share with Muslims, because they believe, as we do, that there is one powerful and omnipotent God who has the world in his control and will bring all things together at the end of time. And that is certainly something we have to share, that we don't have to share with other religions, such as Hinduism. Although I think a pure Hindu would tell you that they do believe in one God, although there's many manifestations. But anyway, it's clear in Islam, in fact, it's the main tenet of Islam, that there is one authoritative God. They also espouse a tolerance to us as people of the book. And this is practiced with varying degrees of success within the Islamic world, In Saudi Arabia, it's not practiced at all. We are allowed no churches and no expression of Christianity at all. In fact, it gets to the ridiculous point sometimes. There it was the national airline named Savia, and I can't quite remember how it was done, but it had something like this. Maybe that doesn't fully draw it out. But anyway, there was in their sign, it looked like there was a cross here. And they were forced to, if you can kind of see the blank spaces here, they were forced to change their logo because it looked like they were had a cross in their logo. So there is a real sense of holding down any expression, any hint of Christianity at all. And to my students, some of them who have been in the West know that there is such a thing as Christmas. But many of them have no idea. I do a little thing when I'm forced to work on Christmas, being that they go by their own calendar. And I usually don't dress up at all. And, on Christmas, I wear a tie to class, which is a very unusual thing for Mr. Avery to do. And students tend to ask questions. And see, we're not allowed to really bring our religion into the classroom at all. But usually it comes out that he's doing it because of Christmas. And some of them have just really surprised me how little concept they have of it at all. So they really are people in the dark about other religions. And it's surprising because Jesus is a symbol or a person of respect within the Islamic tradition. But not so much in Saudi Arabia. And I want to stress that that's different in different Islamic countries. Some Islamic countries, Christianity, of course, existed long before Islam did, 6 centuries before it did, and had a very strong base and continues to. And those would be countries like Syria, or Egypt, or Lebanon, Jordan. But there are some that have no tradition, or no current tradition of Christian church at all. There is also with the Islamic people a lack of self-consciousness and confidence in being different for one's religion. They have no sense of shyness or kind of not being self-assured. There is a definite confidence in being one of God's people, and they don't hide that at all. Prayers are out in the open for everyone to see. And there is a righteous respect for God in that sense of, and God is holy, God is just, and he is in everything. In the words of greeting, salam alaikum, it means peace be upon you, or God's peace be upon you. And the way to say goodbye is masalama, God be with you. Or may God's peace be upon you as you go. So there is very, the language shows the respect for God in that way.
May I ask a question on number 3?
Mm-hmm.
That's lack of self-consciousness, but not lack of confidence. Is that what you're saying?
Right. That may be a little confusing. Right.
Exactly.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. And part of what I want to do tonight is, a lot of you have attended the sessions during the week, and I'm sure you've had many thoughts about the subject, and I would like you to ask to help me form a Christian perspective of Islam as we go through this tonight, because, as I said, there's no one set answer. I've asked some people to come tonight particularly to do that. Do you have any other feedback at this point? Yes?
What do they think of our God, though, who is a triune God? Don't they get upset?
Well, this is an essential difference, yes, between Christianity and Islam. Is they see us as polytheists, in that sense, or see Pauline Christianity in that way. And they reinterpret parts of the New Testament and represent them in the Quran. So Jesus wasn't divine. Right, so they do not worship Christ as we do. Anybody else? Positive points about Islam that you can Then?
Well, I think the undercurrent, which you've already said, that because we've heard the word Allah, and many times we often think that's the name for another deity,
mm-hmm.
or another God, and the consciousness they have that it's the Arabic translation of the word God, and the consciousness they have that they're worshiping the same God,
mm-hmm.
even if they can't quite understand why we do all the Trinity stuff.
Right. In fact, they don't like us when talking about Islam to use the word Allah, in terms, even though to me it seems respectful, because they don't want to seem like we're referring to another God.
So what would they say?
So they prefer to just use our own word.
God.
Any other thoughts? Positive. Okay, then I had some negative things. I think some points of difference that... that have come up during the week that I'd like to emphasize now. And I think the main difference for me anyway is viewing God mainly as the judge. We think of John 3:16, which is familiar to all of us, for God so loved the world that he sent his only son to the world. This sense of vulnerability that God would sacrifice himself or sacrifice his son is anathema to the Muslim. That sense of vulnerability, of willingness to be killed, there is one thing to be a martyr at the hands of others and to be in retribution against it, as I think the Shiites have the idea of they are going to establish their world eventually. But not the martyr as a sacrifice, as a redeeming aspect. God is merciful. God has the ability to extend mercy to those who repent in Islam. But the emphasis is on God the Creator, the Holy, the Powerful One. And that's the difference of night and day, I think, between Christianity and Islam. Because it makes a much more severe, a much more authoritarian perception of God. The cross is unthinkable, the folly of God. And I think by looking at Islam, we can appreciate how much that means to us of Christ's sacrifice for us.
Okay, this question, is there a tradition of charity, of helping the poor, the needy?
Yes.
What's the theological basis of it?
Because we are God's created beings, and all people are God's created beings, very much as we do, and that we have to share the abundance what we have. You mean in terms of self-sacrificing? I think everything in Islam is done out of a sense of obedience, because it's in the Quran, because it is said that we must do it, then we must be obedient to it. There's no direct sense of sin. There's not a strong theology of sin in Islam. You know, of personal being in regret for what he has done wrong, but merely that one goes on from that and is obedient, because if you're not obedient, then you stand to be judged.
John, I don't understand then the theme of repentance.
A repentance not so much from what you've... Yes, there is a repentance from what you've done, but it's a hard one for me to understand coming from a Christian perspective. How can you have repentance if there's no sin? I think it's merely meant to be more obedience from then on, without worrying about what's going on before. It translates into everyday life that we see at the university. Is when the university does things that irritate us, they will never, maybe this is the nature of institutions, but they will never apologize. They will never say, we're sorry, or we messed up, on a personal level. It's just not done. It's like they will say, next month the checks will be out on time, or next month this and this and this. But it's not like, we're sorry that we confused you, or anything like that.
Do you have
an
idea of an example of personal reconciliation, interpersonal reconciliation? You're saying there's no ritual for that, like a formula, like you teach kids to say, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sure, there is a sense of being kind to one another. My students are very polite people on the whole, and I enjoy teaching them for the most part. I like to motivate them a little bit more than they seem motivated, but maybe that's the nature of students and teachers. But really feeling remorse for what you've done wrong to another. And
for instance, if you've seen two people that have been at odds with each other, or that somebody's really done wrong to somebody else,
mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen that worked out in some kind of dynamics among the students or among the people you know that?
Maybe I just haven't gotten enough into the culture to see that. Yeah. Maybe there's things that happen in their own language and I had no interaction like that where I needed that kind of reconciliation. I know that grudges are held for a long time.
That's the consequence of the reconciliation.
Yeah.
Long
time. And that there is a great deal of divisiveness within the faculty of the university, the Arab faculty, and that criticism that I have of it is it's hard for it to work together as a university, because everybody is trying to establish their power base. But maybe, again, that's the nature of institutions as a whole.
Then is there any concept of love? If there's no self-sacrifice, self-giving, how can there be love? You must not have concept of love.
There is a concept of love. Certainly, fathers love their children. And there is a sense that God is merciful. And God does bring us into his family. But maybe what I need to say is, instead of there isn't one, it's not as strong or it's not as pervasive as it is in our religion. And it seems to me the base of Christ's sacrifice and the base of our understanding of why we're Christians is his love for us over sin. I don't know. Sometimes I think the people lift themselves above their religion, as I see it, as it's explained to me. That there's something in the people that is stronger, more loving. Good question. And as I say, I'm merely one of you who are over there happening to be working in that part of the world. But these are some precepts that are read and seen explained.
How do they explain the concept of mercy when they, have conversion by the sword, which was the way of conversion when Muhammad?
That's often a misunderstanding of Islamic history. Is that they were converted at the point of the sword, kind of like the Christians hid in the catacombs. It's something that's been carried on that isn't entirely true. When they extended their empire, they became a very minor part of the empire. And they were seen more as liberators rather than a dominant empire. What's the word I'm looking for? As imperial. Because they were closer to the people that they were liberating, particularly in the areas of Egypt. Now, there were Jews and Christians in the regions that they imperialized. And they allowed them to keep their religion. And in fact, it was to the benefit of the empire to let them keep their religion, because tribute was taken only from non-Muslims, a tax that's paid. So if a person converted, he maintained the privilege of not having to pay taxes. So it wasn't exactly to their advantage to convert everybody. Now, the religion did spread, and the religion has extended to, as I said, from Spain, which is no longer Muslim, of course, across the Middle East. But
you can't deny that there was force involved in the conflict, can you?
Oh, there's definitely force in the military sense, but I'm not sure there was force in, and you will accept or you will be slain. Otherwise, they would have had to slay almost everyone immediately, and they were a very small force. And they were very, very, wise or perceptive imperialists. I mean, if they had generated enough opposition, their numbers were too small to stand up against that kind of opposition. extent.
From my memory of reading the history, I think one important point in that part of the world, Northern Africa, it was a time when the church, the Christian church, was at a point of real corruption.
Mm-hmm.
The Byzantine church was a church that was spiritually dead. And that when the Muslims came, it was really, again, finding something that was bringing spiritual life. But there's a tremendous amount of responsibility to a corrupt, dead Christian church that operated in that part of the world at that time. That the coming of Islam was really a liberation for people, and a revival and a restoration of living religion. But he puts a lot of, points a lot back at our history of the Christian church.
Yeah, it was seen as a simple religion available to the common man. And that's one of the reasons it spread so widely in an area so diverse.
And we'd like to think these were all strong, faithful Christian countries that were forced into Islam. It's a painful part of our history, I think we have to see.
In fact, in the Crusades, as I said yesterday, it was so-called Christian Europe, which really benefited from the Crusades in terms of absorbing the culture of the Middle East, which had flourished. The opposite of what happened to the culture of Europe at that time.
John, it seems to me at the same time, and this may be getting ahead of your story in terms of not reaching the political thing yet, but related to the same subject, it's...
Go ahead.
At the same time, it seems to me that both the Christian Church and Islam have, as the embarrassing part of our history, having been associated so closely with expansionist, imperialist, military conquest.
Mm-hmm.
And whether the Islams did it or not, we certainly, in the Americas, as well as in Europe and in Africa, converted by the sword.
Mm-hmm.
And masses of people baptized by the sword. And whether or not the Islam used the same forces we did in the conversion, the embarrassment that both of us will have to ultimately deal with, and we still none of us have dealt with, either in Christianity or Islam, is the fact that we associated our faith to political expansionism and imperialism and conquest, and in the name of a merciful God. And somehow that I don't see how either Islam or Christianity can continue to rationalize that.
Yeah. The thing with that, there's an essential difference between Islam and Christianity in that sense, is that of course Christ in no way promoted military action at all, whereas Muhammad didn't participate in it. So that right from the beginning there was that essential difference.
But for Christianity it's a greater contradiction to
right.
do what we did.
Right. Right. So you're a great hypocrite. Okay. The second point, which I find is negative, is there is a rigid self-righteousness. I never really understood Pharisees until I got there. And I think there is a great deal of similarity between the people that Jesus had to deal with and the people in the Middle East today. And that's one of the reasons it's one of the most difficult parts of the world in which to find peace. There's a hard-headedness, a sense of self-righteousness. I'm right, and doesn't matter what else, and this is going to happen. There were some verses that I wanted to refer to, particularly the Colossians one, which illustrates this, or speak against it. Saw it in one student who, there's a tradition in Saudi Arabia of what we call the Mutawa, and these are the so-called religious police. And they are out to be the most strict and humorless sort of people possible. And this one student who I had would continually come to class and say, "Please, teacher, can I come in 5 minutes late? I have to go finish prayers." And we particularly arrange our schedule so that that is not a conflict. And we're told by the administration that the prayers are done in time for them to come to class. And so I would say no. And a conflict continued to develop with the student. Now, I probably would deal with him more maturely now, but in my first year, it became a power struggle. At the end of that semester, he was so vindictive that he actually said to me once, "I'm going to get you. I'm going to get you off the faculty." And there was a real sense of vindictiveness and self-righteousness on his part. Like, I had no right to contradict his willingness to go out and say prayers, where actually I think he wanted to get an additional cup of coffee. Let's see if I have this. If with Christ you died to the elemental spirits of the earth, of the universe, why do you live as if you still belong to the world? Why do you submit to regulations? Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, referring to the things which all perish as they are used, according to human precepts and doctrines. These have indeed an appearance of wisdom in promoting rigor of devotion and self-abasement and severity to the body, but they are of no value in checking the indulgence. And there's this appearance of things that seems so important. But in reality, in a real true spiritual sense, I don't think they have much currency. I don't think, and if I take this on from really defeating the real problem at issue. And it seems to me like in Saudi Arabia there are numerous rules. Do not do this. Do not drink wine. Do not eat pork. Do not. Women are supposed to be dressed in such and such a way, and in such a way to try to maintain the religion, whereas these, to me, seem to be external things, not things in the heart. Yeah.
Coupled with that rigid self-righteousness, I started reading a book on the Sufis, which is an off-branch of Islam, and as you're saying, very little spiritual mysticism, very little of the spirit and in the hearts. It's like the clash between the new Christians and the Pharisees is just, they don't really understand mysticism.
Right. The motivation of the heart. It seems to me much of it is external. Christ had, it seems, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed to have his greatest conflicts with the Pharisees, the religious folk of the day, who put their faith in the appearance of things rather than the reality or in their true ability to care for the poor, to care for the spiritual man.
Well, John, aren't there some Muslim mystics of some sort? Like,
well, that would be the Sufis.
Sufis.
Yeah. But they aren't really in the mainstream. And as I said, I haven't traveled a whole lot. I've been in Jordan. It's the only other Arab country I've been in. But in which is more relaxed than Saudi Arabia. For example, at the hotel that we stayed at, they had a special table for those who wanted to eat pork, and then, you know, they had a sign. But in Saudi Arabia, that's unthinkable to have that kind of tolerance to allow it to happen. So there's a real investment in the external thing, which I think we all have to be careful as religious people of not putting our faith in going to church on Sunday or reading so many books or saying a set prayer. But it really is up to us to maintain our relationship with God. It's going to be vital and rich and genuine. There are some technical problems which I see, which I'm sure if we had a Muslim here to explain them, they might seem less of a problem. But there were special revelations to Muhammad, the special revelation of rewriting history. And as I read this explanation, it reminded me of the book by George Orwell, 1984, where there's a rearrangement of history to one's own purposes. And that seems a dangerous kind of thing, that if you rearrange what's happened before, you're changing reality itself to your own purposes. And so they have changed, for example, the crucifixion to be not the crucifixion of Christ, but one in appearance like him. There are politically and personally advantageous revelations. For example, incorporating the rituals that already existed for the idol worshippers who came to Mecca, incorporating them into Islam, and they remain there today. Circling around the Kaaba, kissing a black stone, which seems to us to be an idol in itself. The well, there's a well they call Zamzam, which is supposed to go back to Hagar. And a lot of these things that they reinterpreted and brought back seem to be politically or personally advantageous. They incorporate some of the traditions of the Jews, brought in Abraham. Abraham, it turns out, happened to be in Saudi Arabia to build the Kaaba. And later, after the Jews rejected him, they were excluded, and the direction of the prayers changed from Jerusalem now towards Mecca. And one particularly famous revelation exempted Muhammad from the restriction of four wives, because he was a special person who got sight. And so he said to receive a special revelation, which exempted himself from having only four wives, and he had nine. So there is that. Yeah, he raises his own salary, right? That sense of, it seems a little fishy. The Quran, as adaptation, what I mean, this is, if you accept the Quran's revelation of history and of the nature of God, it means that you reject the Bible. And I think as an historical theological document, you can accept it as a poetical historical document of the Islamic peoples. But the opposite is true for them. If they accept the Quran, they must of necessity reject our revelation, the revelation that come in the Judeo Christians. Were there any other negative things that anybody wanted to bring up? Okay. Well, if I continue with my little chart, get into something a little more, what our reaction should be. And these are just general kind of things that seem common sense to me, and that we should have extend to all people. Tolerance, dialogue, and care in dealing with them. We have not to reject Islamic peoples for being different or for changing the scriptures, but that we should maintain a dialogue, try to understand one another more and more. There's a lot that we have to learn. Particularly since and this is politically too, since people in Islamic countries have maintained more of a power base in our world and more prominence. The world is getting to be a much smaller place, economically, communicatively, and we need to maintain a dialogue.
Well, I gather the initiative is ours in that regard.
No, not entirely, no. They certainly want to be seen as people who look and want to, at least in our country, want to maintain that. But I think if it need be, the initiative should be ours. Okay. Any other thoughts on that? A reaction to Islam? Yes?
Are you
have
tolerance, their tolerance to the people of the book, or your positive points? So, seeing that we see on TV that they're not very tolerant towards us in Iran, Syrian folks, being that the Native Americans in Libya, likewise, there are people of Libya and Iran, are they different kinds of
In Iran, yes, they are. They are the Shiite sect, and I think that is a particularly difficult group to deal with, because they have this sense of martyrdom and of cause, particularly now that they're politically motivated and economically underwritten by the oil revenue. And that's a spreading movement. The strongest religious movement in the Middle East today is religious conservatism. It's extending through Palestine, through all the areas of the Middle East. And that's something difficult to deal with. No, they are not extending tolerance, particularly in Iran. there is a sense of the U.S. as the devil, the great Satan, stomping on the flag and so on. But what are we to do with that? And I want to get to that in the section on politics. But as a religion, seeing them as Muslims, I think we need to be tolerant as a religion. I also think there is a great need for missionary work, thoughtful missionary work, I should say, because I really feel for the aridness of some of these people in their lives. I feel like, as we do for many people in our own culture, that there's a real emptiness. And I don't think that Islam offers much to their heart.
How can you possibly operate, I guess in Jordan and other places like that, it's possible, but how could you possibly operate as a missionary in a place like Saudi Arabia?
You can't. They've closed themselves to the gospel. I mean, unless you wanted to go and risk imprisonment and martyrdom, you can't be an open missionary. And it's very difficult to be a closed missionary because everything is so tight. I mean, the word would get around soon if you were inviting Muslims to your home for conversion.
Do you know any place in the Middle East where there's real active dialogue going on?
I imagine there must be in countries like Jordan or Egypt. I know in Egypt there's a real history of interaction. And so, yes, there is dialogue. I think the majority, and we have to remember that Saudi Arabia only has 6 million people in comparison to a country like Egypt, which I'm not even sure how many people they have, but it's supposed to be 8 or 10 million in Cairo alone. So there's a need, I think, for Christians to interact and for those called to it, to go to the Muslim world. It must be one of the most difficult assignments in some of these countries because there is a lot of misunderstanding.
Would you almost give up? I know a Protestant missionary who worked in the Muslim world and Vietnam professor at CSU, but he's hopeless. He says maybe he can convert one Christian to a different flavor, but he's keeping the
very tight system.
Demoralized.
You know, in Saudi Arabia, the penalty for changing from being a Muslim is death. And it can be carried out by law if it would be to their advantage. I imagine if a member of the royal family, for example, proclaimed himself a Christian and wanted to stay in Saudi Arabia, it would be impossible. I don't know if they'd kill him, but they would certainly expel him. At least in Saudi Arabia, there's no tolerance at all.
Well, there's other countries too. I know our bishop went over to Turkey, and he said that they could not wear clerical garb, they could not wear a cross, they could not wear any symbol of Christianity. When they went to the Christian cathedral to meet the patriarch, Constantinople, and they had to put all of their vestments and everything in the suitcase, and they had to vest there in the church because they were not allowed to openly display Christian symbols. Mm-hmm. And this is in a more open country, supposedly, than Iran or Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. where there is a Christian presence and there's still persecution.
I need some clarification. I know that there's no separation of church and state in any of the sense that we have it in parts of Christianity, but at what point are we discussing the beliefs of Islam, leaving the beliefs of Islam and getting into a political stance of a country using Islam to express that political stance? For example, in Mexico, a Christian, a Mexican or a foreigner, can also not wear clerics. And that's a result of the Mexican Revolution of 1912.
Cannot wear religious
garb except within one block of their church. And that's an act of a state. Mm-hmm. That also identifies in increasingly strong ways, again, with Christianity. And I'm just wondering if we're discussing Islam when in the harsh stance of Saudi Arabia, are we discussing the beliefs of Islam or the political system that uses Islam as an expression of its political system. Because you can get very confused if that distinction is not made, unless I totally misunderstand it.
No, it's interpreted differently in many different countries, depending on how much sway the government holds with the people, or how much, you know, how much of an authoritarian dictatorial government it is. I think in Saudi Arabia they use Islam to as a means of maintaining order. In other countries, like Pakistan, that's been an attempt also, but the people require it. They want a government that's going to institute strict Islamic laws to cut off hands if need be in the case of and some politicians currency out of that they are elected on that basis or build their popularity. But I don't know if I'm getting at your question.
Well, I was asking the question particularly in relationship to the espousal, official espousal of tolerance as part of Islam teaching, if I understood you correctly, and then it being contradicted in some countries. Is that variation?
Tolerance is a dangerous thing, isn't it? I mean, open-mindedness is a dangerous thing whether you're dealing with politics or religion. And in the case where they're put together, it can be very dangerous to the stability of the government. If they're truly tolerant, then there's a possibility that other political parties or people with very different basis of motivation can rise up and be a powerful force in the country.
Well, there are countries where Islam is an important part, but it's not the
Philippines or Malaysia.
Israel, where you can have a town with a synagogue or a mosque in the same.
In where?
In Israel. Where both those do coexist in whatever uneasy fashion, but when you're a minority, you have to be common too.
Yeah, that's right. There are countries where, like in Egypt, where it's more or less a secular government, or Syria, where Islam is the state church, if you will, but it doesn't prohibit the expression of other faith. There are ways in which they allow other, you know, it gives freedom, the civil liberty, in some countries, it gives civil liberty to express.
I guess I'm asking if you have a sense of which reflects more truly the nature of Islam.
Well,
the tolerance or the lack of tolerance?
That's hard to answer because I don't know if that was ever acted out. It was acted out in Muhammad's small community in Medina, where there was supposed to be a tolerance for the Jews, but at one point when he suspected the Jews of betraying him, he slaughtered them and sent their women and children to slavery. That was Muhammad himself. So I think they would like to be tolerant, but when it gets in the way, it's easily disposed of. Okay. Let me just go on. Politically, Islam is a positive, as a political structure, some positive aspects. These very things that we're talking about of tying faith and politics together, faith and action together, faith and life, can be seen in a very positive way. The people want to be responsible to God, and they want to institute that in the government. And there's also a sense, as people of God, a rejection of the creed that rejects God, the rejection of Marxism. A strong rejection of that in many Islamic countries, and they're not in the Soviet sphere of influence. Some are, Syria, for example, and Libya, but I think those are more anomalies than the norm. Iran, for example, has much fear and hatred of Russia as they do of us. So we're equal. On the negative end of things, Islam is a political structure. This combination of faith and life, it can, as seen in extreme forms, can be a living lesson to those who would establish a Christian state, return to the Constantinian kind of arrangement for us. I think there's a strong argument in viewing the world politics today, and particularly the politics in the Middle East, to maintain what we have now, and that's separation of church and state. It really scares me when those kind of values, that separation is impinged on. I think if we maintain, if we lose that, we're going to end up with intolerance being law, because there's always going to be a dominant group. And in the United States, in the democratic tradition, we are given the protection of the minority, and that's not the case in the Islamic world. The minority isn't as important as the main part. Also, it leads to compromises, that's threatening to the religion itself. There's a lot of arguments, for example, that the state churches in Europe have compromised and diluted European Christianity to the point where it has a little credibility. And the dominant movements, religion-wise in Europe, are not with like the English church, but with the other churches, right? You know, growing. Yeah. Just one more page. What should our reaction be to Islam as a political structure? Well, a lot of thoughts. One that I should have put at the top of the list is we have not yet come to terms with the Palestinian question, and that is the primary force that separates us from the people of the Middle East. What about the Palestinians who were excluded from their homeland when they established the state of Israel and continue to lose ground? Until we do deal with that justly and question our support for arms and extension of policy in the Middle East, we're going to have to, that's a major question to deal with. We've got just a couple minutes before we go through. But in the case of a country like Iran, where it seems to be clear evil and expansion and fanaticism, that we ought not to be timid in dealing with evil. The situation in Libya struck me as the government trying, I felt in two minds about it, and I'll try to express that here quickly. In some way, I remember immediately Chamberlain dealing with Hitler, coming back and saying we have peace in our time, and not standing up to the threat. Gaddafi in no way had the power of Hitler, but he is an irrational man, and we can't be timid with that kind of behavior. But we have to see what motivates it, too, and part of that is the Palestinian question. Other thing, when we enter the devil's playground, and we play by his rules, and by entering into the situation of bombing in Libya, in a sense, it's entering into the rules of the Middle East. I remember the play on Thomas More, A Man for All Seasons, where one of his followers, when he was the Chancellor of England, a very powerful position, and when St. Thomas More was being threatened by the law, that in the end he lost his life for, the man said, well, change the law, change it to your own purposes, basically, he was saying. And his response to that was, when we change the law, when we cut down the trees of the law that separate us, and in this case international law, or decorum of way of acting with other countries, we stand on the open plain where the winds of the devil may destroy us as well as our enemy. And I think that we have got to be patient and deal strongly in some way. And I don't know what I would have done if I was the president. But we've also got to respect international law in the way of dealing with crises. Another thing about the Libyan bombing that frightens me is that it gives the American people a dangerous illusion of the effectiveness of that kind of action. A quick, dirty, effective retribution, and that, if anything, has never worked in the Middle East. The Middle East is nothing but the history of long memories. Long memories and vindictive attitudes of millennia of hatred, fighting one against the other. And if we enter into that, we're going to be dragged down by it. And that's a very dangerous illusion. And I think it builds up that Rambo sense of we're going to assert our will no matter what. And we can't. We're not positioned to do that. I don't think we want to be an imperial power in the Middle East. That's the only way we could ruthlessly go in and assert our will. But it's going to, it does give that dangerous illusion that kind of action will be conclusive, and it won't be conclusive, it will only continue the situation. And I guess in the end, we as Christians have to hope in gentle justice, which is the theme here of Bolden for the summer. Somehow, in reasoning it out, to try to have justice, either through economic sanctions or some way respond to the threats that we see, but hopefully not get dragged down into the military combativeness at all. Now, I'm sorry there's no more time for discussion. I'd be happy to extend this or to meet and talk in groups. That's all.